You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
This book is crucial because, I'll tell you first, I once wrote a book, a bestseller, The Power of No, and the publisher asked me, what do I want to write next? And I said, I want to write The Power of Ask because I'm horrible at it. And I'm so bad at it, I couldn't write the book. I'm so glad I didn't write the book because you would have embarrassed me with this book because it's so solid and you give such practical techniques. But I have to ask, like, for me, I feel really uncomfortable asking upwards. You know, if I need something and it's something that I think is a little bit hard for the other person to give or it's a bigger ask than normal, I feel I can't do it. I'm just so awkward doing it. I just can't ask for anything. And I'm sure you encounter this a lot.
Yeah, I think it's true for most people. It's true for me sometimes as well. We ought to refer to our negotiation colleagues here, I think.
Yeah. From teaching negotiations a few times, I think the biggest thing that I learned was that it's often easier to ask for advice than help.
Yes. So as a negotiator, I always start off a negotiation asking for advice. And that, by the way, is in your quick start method. That's one of the ideas in your quick start method.
Right. Right. That's right.
So we're coming full circle.
People always ask me, like, what's a good business strategy? What's a good investment? How can I make money quickly? How can I come up with ideas for a best-selling book? You know what the answer is? First, take care of your body. First, be healthy. You cannot be creative. You cannot be successful or have energy if you're not healthy. So I'm going to tell you what I do personally every day to feel fully energized. I just take Athletic Greens. Athletic Greens is a plant-based supplement sourced from Whole Foods at the highest quality. Seriously, you won't find any harmful chemicals, artificial colors, artificial flavors, preservatives, artificial sweeteners, or added sugar. Has no GMOs, herbicides, pesticides, no wheat, dairy, gluten, corn, lactose, sucrose, dextrose, egg, yeast, peanuts, or animal products. It's like magic how green this is. So I'll tell you how I do it. It's really simple. I usually have a bunch of their travel packs with me, and I just add water, shake, and drink. Done. So I really want you to try this and get all the benefits, at least experience it. Go to athleticgreens.com/James, and you can get 20 free travel packs, which is a $79 value, with your first purchase. Just go to this link, athleticgreens.com/James, and claim your special offer today. It's available in the U.S., Canada, U.K., and EU. That's athleticgreens.com/James. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
All right.
All right. First of all, how's the family?
Well, thank you for asking. My son is just turning 18 next week, almost done with high school and applying to colleges and going through that whole, I don't quite know the word for it, but it wasn't as easy as when I did it.
I have two daughters. I have two daughters turning 18 within the next 2 months. They're all applying to colleges. It is a drag. Now, you guys are professors, but I keep telling them, don't go to college. but that's a topic for another podcast. But yeah, it's hard. They're all stressing out. How's Adam? How's your family?
Everyone's doing pretty well. I feel like, when we decided to have a third child, everyone told us that the zone defense would be the hardest part. I have a different experience now that our youngest is six. I feel like the problem is more combinatorics. That when there were two kids, there was only one fight that could ever happen at once. But now we can have three different fights going at the same exact time.
Not only that, with three kids, it's always two versus one. And that's like a permanent situation. It just depends. Every morning, it's a different two.
Things to look forward to. Thanks for the warning. How are yours?
It's good because I got married. And so she had three kids and I had two. So now I have five. And that's a combinatorics problem. A very complicated one because it could be cross family. It could be female versus male. You never know where the war, where the line's going to be drawn in the war zone.
Oh, well, I have experience with that one. So, I'm part of a family of nine. There were four on my father's side, four on my stepmother's side, and they had a child, the ninth. So I have a half brother there. So I have stepsisters, stepbrothers, full sisters, full brothers, and a half brother.
So your therapy session takes like 4 hours.
Or really, it takes that long just to organize the chairs.
Right, right. And how's, you're both professors. How are classes this year?
Adam, you teaching this quarter or this semester?
No, I finished in December and won't be back in the classroom till August. So I have no idea when school is even back in session.
Wait, how come? Are you writing a book?
Oh, I always teach only in the fall.
Okay, that's good for you. And what are you doing recreationally these days? What are your hobbies?
It's recreation.
Adam, I don't believe you have recreation because you're like constantly giving or taking. And
oh dear. Trying to get better at asking with Wayne's guidance and yours as well. I'm excited to be a fly on the wall for this actually, but as far as free time is concerned, it's been mostly ultimate frisbee, reading, and lots of video games with our kids.
But when you read though, because you're constantly doing research for the next book, do you feel like it's not fun unless it's like moving you forward in terms of progress for your next book? Like, what do you read for fun? I have this issue as well.
Yeah. So I've been a science fiction junkie since I was about 12 years old. And I've always got a couple of books going and always looking for new stuff. But it's like, you know, some people like murder mysteries, other types of books, other genres. But for me, it's science fiction.
For me too. And lately I've been getting into a lot of these Chinese science fiction authors that are just being translated over here, like The Three Body Problem or The Paper Menagerie, the books like that.
Yeah, I've read that. The Dark Forest, the whole thing. That was a great series.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And then Adam, what do you read for fun? You like a Jack Reacher fan?
So I also read a lot of sci-fi. I just read the Unwind Distology, which was totally fascinating. I think Neil Schusterman, if I remember correctly. I also love the Magician's trilogy, and I read
Grossman,
plenty of
like that.
Yeah, so well done. But I read a lot of spy novels too. I was like trying to figure out a mystery.
What spy novels? I haven't read a spy novel actually. I would like to.
So
what do you recommend?
If I were going to start with something that's not necessarily that well known, it would be The Zero Hour by Joseph Finder.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was incredible.
I've read one of his books a long time ago, like his first book. I thought it was really good, and I haven't read anything since. Do you ever feel...
I thought it was his best. And then if you haven't done I Am Pilgrim yet by Terry Hayes, it is an unbelievably good thriller.
And then finally, we're about to start talking about asking, and Wayne, your advice is brilliant. This is going to be such a valuable podcast, maybe the most valuable ever. And then we're going to talk about the business you guys started revolving around how to ask. But is this when you start the day? What do you dream for? Like, what do you hope for in all of this? Like, Wayne, you're about to publish a book, or you just published the book by the time this podcast comes out. What are your dreams right now?
Oh, that's, it's nice of you to ask. Well, you know, I'm considerably older than Adam, and I'm sort of in the last stage of my career. And I really would like to make a positive difference in people's lives. And I find that, the book is really a culmination of work over many different years, many different projects, work I've done with Adam and others. And I've seen that when people apply the lessons of the book, it really makes a big difference in their lives, their careers, and their families. And so I want to get the message out as wide as possible so that as many people can benefit from it.
Well, it's so, I have to tell you a story, but first, this book is so valuable and some of the specific techniques I am so glad you wrote about. I am the worst at asking people for help in the universe. And this book, the techniques you describe, which we're going to talk about, is going to help me so much. I just did one of the techniques, which was your Ford technique, asking about family, occupation, recreation, and dreams, to just to kind of, get things flowing, because sometimes people are hard to talk to. But it feels a little bit artificial going like in order like that. And sometimes people don't necessarily want to talk about some of these things, but you guys did very good. You played along very nicely.
You did it so professionally and smoothly, I didn't even recognize that that's what you were doing.
Really? I thought it was too obvious. Adam, you recognized what I was doing, right?
I didn't recognize it, but I was a little curious about why you were asking us random questions that had nothing to do with the podcast. And then I thought, okay, why do I do this when I'm interviewing someone? And the answer is, I want to warm people up, maybe build rapport a little bit. So I just assumed you were being friendly. I stand corrected.
That is the chapter that Wayne wrote about warming people up. Don't you guys read your own books?
I do, but there's a lot of words in there to remember.
Sometimes after I finish a book, and then I'm interviewed about it, I completely forget the entire contents of the book, because you kind of like throw everything into it, and then mentally you're exhausted and it's no longer in your short-term RAM anymore, and it hasn't had the chance to go into your ROM, and I just forget everything. People say, well, what's your advice for the book? And I'm like, did I just write a book? I have no idea what you're talking about. But your book is, I'm gonna read the title because I always forget this. All you have to do is ask how to master the most important skill for success. This is Wayne Baker, and Adam, you wrote the foreword. Am I correct? I forget. Or you're kind of a blurb at the top. You're a blurb at the top on the back. But this book is crucial, because I'll tell you first, I once wrote a book, a bestseller, The Power of No, and the publisher asked me, what do I want to write next? And I said, I want to write The Power of Ask, because I am horrible at it. And I'm so bad at it, I couldn't write the book. I'm so glad I didn't write the book, because you would have embarrassed me with this book, because it's so solid and you give such practical techniques. But I have to ask, for me, I feel really uncomfortable asking upwards. So if someone is, if I need something, I feel really, and it's something that I think is a little bit hard for the other person to give, or it's a bigger ask than normal, I feel I can't do it. I'm just so awkward doing it. Let's say I just publish a book and I go to, I don't know, the number one podcast in the world, and I said, hey, this will be fun for you to talk about. Your listeners would love this. I can't ask that. I just can't ask for anything. And I'm sure you encounter this a lot.
Yeah, I think it's true for most people. It's true for me sometimes as well. But if you take that example that you finished a book and you want to get it on the number one podcast, is that podcaster is also looking for really good guests to have and books to talk about. So in a way, you have to realize that you're also giving something to that person. You may be asking to be considered to be on their program, but you're also giving them the material and the guests that they need. That's like both sides are necessary. Maybe it's helpful to remind yourself of that. Or if you think of what is that higher purpose or higher good that you're serving, that maybe it's not just about you, but it's about getting the message out, making a difference in people's lives. I think, if you kind of go through that intentionality before asking, it can help to really be clear about why you're asking and the motivations behind it and why it's meaningful. And I think that can make a difference.
Well, I always, and by the way, what you just said, we could go directly into the method of accomplishing what you just said, which kind of overcomes that objection that I'm about to say, which is so the first objection I have to what you say is I rationalize not asking by saying, oh, 10,000 people are asking for X, Y, or Z. I'm just going to be one in a crowd. Asking removes power from me, you know, and I'm afraid to do that. I'll lose too much status in my own eyes or maybe in the eyes of others. And I just have a hard time. It's like, I don't have the inner frame, the inner confidence to do the big ask.
Well, you know, I think it's a habit. You know, it takes what I found when one of my motivations for writing the book was that I had learned over time that just kind of educating people or increasing awareness about it wasn't enough, that you also have to give an answer to the how to. You have to say, what are the tools? What are the practices? Very specifically, what can you do? So the book is very tool focused, very practice focused, because I really wanted to say, okay, well, here's how to do it. Here's ways in which all these other kinds of people have done it and teams have done it. Take some of those and run an experiment. You know, try it out. Try it out in a safe place. Maybe that's at home or with friends or in a community rather than at work. But, you know, I think over time we become better at it, like any habit.
That's a great idea to experiment in safe places. So let's go over one of the methods. I mean, we're going to go over a bunch of methods in here. And also I want to go back and forth to different definitions you have. And some of this relates to Adam's excellent book, which he was on the podcast several years about, called Give and Take. You talk about overly generous givers and you talk about selfish takers who sometimes ask too much. Oh, so yeah, before we get to a technique, I have one question about that. Sometimes people say to me, have a big ask to me towards me. And then they say, and I say no. And then they say, oh, well, it doesn't hurt to ask. I don't like that phrase, it doesn't hurt to ask. Sometimes it does hurt another person to ask, because if you ask for too much and you show me you haven't respected my time or my agenda, I don't really, you go down a level in my book. And so that's the problem I also have with asking is I never want to feel like I'm crossing a line. I never want to say it doesn't hurt to ask, because sometimes it does.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, people are a little vulnerable when they ask. Getting rejected is often, you know, that's no fun, you know, but a request is not a demand. The request is simply that, it's a request. And I think, I think if you get turned down, there's information in that you could learn. It's like sometimes just following up, and I write a little bit about this, following up with the why to the denial can sometimes be a way in which people can learn. To make a better ask the next time, or
Sorry for interrupting, but what I'm saying is, as sometimes when I'm the person being asked, and then and I say no, and they say something like, "Oh, it doesn't hurt to ask." Sometimes I think to myself, it did hurt them just now to ask me, and it's, yes. Perhaps it's because when I was reading your book, I realized it's because they're not using, even instinctively, some of the tools you write about in this book, which I think are necessary. But maybe talk about when it does actually hurt a person to ask before we get into how to ask.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe we need to think a little bit more about in what ways does it hurt to ask when, like, people say it doesn't hurt to ask.
Well, it hurts them if I can see very clearly that they're not respecting my time or my agenda. In life, they're not thinking about what my purposes and interests and agendas are, and they're just thinking about theirs. And they ask, something about the fact that they then say it doesn't hurt to ask. I always think to myself, it actually did just hurt you to ask because you went lower in my estimation of you.
So you think they hurt their reputation and they also damaged their relationship with you?
Yes, because I felt very strongly that they didn't take into account, at a basic level, what my agenda might have been in life. Like, we should all take into account each other's agendas to some extent.
Gotcha. I was thinking about it from the other way, that the person making the ask, does it hurt them?
Yeah, and it does hurt them if...
In the sense that it hurts them internally, or at least they feel like they're taking a risk.
Right. So So, right, in that sense, it might not hurt them because they justify it by saying it doesn't hurt to ask. So they think their the damage to them is minimal. But in fact, they don't realize they might have lost status or respect from me.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you know, Adam, the way you put it, I think is perfect.
So what is it then that causes that loss of respect or, you know, the damage to social capital? It seems like, James, at the heart of your reaction is a sense that, you know, I guess the basic thing I took away from your frustration is you don't want somebody to be asking in a way that seems purely selfish.
Exactly.
Or that makes you feel used.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't want to be dealing with what you would call a selfish taker. I'm fine if someone says, hey, I've got a great book I'm really proud of. You know, I listened to your podcast ABC that seems similar, and this is kind of a unique enhancement on what they were saying. I'm happy to, you know, stop by anytime, you know, when you have free time. Like, if I don't know them and they're kind of introducing themselves and asking, then it seems like, okay, they've thought about the ask. But if they just say, hey, I just wrote a book about, you know, flowers, which you may or may not be interested in. Can I come on your podcast and talk about it? Because I really want to sell a lot of books. Then I say no, and then they say, okay, well, it didn't hurt to ask. Actually, it did.
Yeah. Yep, I definitely see that.
Unless, of course, James, their goal was to damage their relationship with you, in which case, it's been a smashing success.
Yes, and you know, by the way, sometimes people do that thinking, if they're not going to say yes to this, then I don't care. So, like, they might not worry about their relationship.
Oh, so it's a test.
Yeah, it could be. And, you know, or if someone's willing to kind of do a Hail Mary, like, I've talked to him before, this is the last time I'm going to try, and then screw it. So, you know, sometimes someone could be a selfish taker on purpose.
Yeah, or it could be that they're fishing, and they're casting lots of lines, hoping they're going to catch a fish somewhere.
Yeah, and like, look, sometimes, on the flip side is, sometimes the asker, like you said, has to be okay with a no, and has to understand the other person's agenda. You have to learn from it. Why did the person say no? And Adam, I'll give as an example. So you've come on the podcast a couple times. After one of your books, you were just busy. I asked if you wanted to come on, and I understood it. You couldn't do it, and but I knew it, and it was no problem because you know, I understood you probably were at, this was after option B. You were probably being asked to go on thousands of podcasts, and I got it. Like, I understood, and it was no problem. It wasn't an issue. I didn't think to myself, like, oh, well, screw him. Like, it was never a problem because when people understand each other's agendas, you could handle both sides of it much more easily.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you weren't offended. Thank you. I still feel guilty.
Feel guilty. I really am sincere. I understand after give and take, you must have been inundated with people saying, oh, well, you're Mr. Give, right? So you got to come on my podcast.
It was quite a trap. And yeah, I mean, there's a huge difference between, I only realized much later, between saying, look, I enjoy being helpful and I want to operate that way as my default in the world, and saying, therefore, everyone who wants my help is entitled to it. And that, you know, that boundary became increasingly important. But also, James, it's really interesting the way that you made that invitation, because you were, from my perspective, you were offering to help me.
Right. Well, that's how I always...
I didn't feel like I was hurting you.
Right.
I was like, oh my gosh, I can't handle any more. And so... you know, hopefully James won't be offended that I didn't take him up on his generous offer this time.
No, yeah, and you're right. So, and this is we're gonna segue into Wayne's specific methods off of this. But I always am trying to think, what's the other person's agenda, so I can incorporate that into the ask. So when someone has a book that comes out, and I admire the person, and I admire the book, and everything else, I will say, hey, I would love to help you with the book, and this is a topic personal to me, would be great to come on the podcast. And then, okay, they say no, but at least I'm thinking of their agenda and vice versa. And then if there's a reasonable reason, so I can learn from it. And I did learn from it. I have about a 20-to-1 ratio, even though I have a very popular podcast, I have about a 20-to-1 ratio of asks to guests. And but I always try to figure out the other person's agenda, which leads me to, you know, Wayne, or should I call you Wayne or Dr. Baker, or, you know, you're a professor at University of Michigan.
No, Wayne, please.
Well, so Wayne, you have this great method. We're going to talk about the SMART method, which is one of your very formal ways of thinking about asking. But you start off with this quick start method of how to ask. And I really love this. I'm going to start incorporating this into my life. I think intuitively I try to do this, but I think the fact that you formalize it helps put a structure around it, which will gives me a little bit more confidence. Maybe will give me a little bit more confidence asking in difficult situations for things. This is such an important topic for success. But maybe we could start off with the quick start method of asking. Do you want to start off what this method is, and then I have some questions.
Sure. So there are three main methods. One is the quick start, and as it's named, it is a quick and effective one to do. There's goal articulation, which is a little bit more involved, and then finally there's positive futuring or visioning, which takes longer. The quick start I always recommend to begin with. In fact, some people have been taking it and starting each morning answering one of those sentences. And as you know from the book, it's sentences that need to be completed, and there's always two parts to it. So it could be, for example, I'm currently working on, and I need to, you know, people would fill in those blanks, or my biggest hope is, and I would benefit from. So people go through and they fill in those two blanks at each of those five sentences. It gives them a really good idea of what they're trying to accomplish and why, and the resource that they need.
So with this method, and then your second one, you know, kind of step two is articulating your goals. So maybe describe an example of that, and then I have a question about these first two methods.
Yeah, so the goal articulation or goal setting method takes a little bit longer, but it essentially involves thinking about different domains of your life. So it could be work, family, spirituality, religion, health and fitness, and to think intentionally about what am I trying to accomplish here in one of these areas. So, okay, well, given that I need to accomplish that, what kind of help do I need? What kind of resources do I need? What would help me be better at actually achieving that particular goal? And then you can go from there to figure out how to ask the question using the SMART criteria, which we'll be getting into. So essentially that's it, but it's that more, it takes a little bit longer to do the goal setting, goal articulation method. It's a little bit more comprehensive than the quick start method. And, you know, I advocate using both. And then finally, the third one, which is visioning, which is creating or painting a picture of your positive future in vivid detail of, you know, say 5 years from now, what do you want your life to be? And describe it as if we went forward in a time machine and we were visiting you and you were telling us about all the great stuff around you and your life and your family at work and your community, your career, all the evidence of what had been accomplished. And then you start working backwards from there. Well, given if that's my vision 5 years from now, my positive future, but what do I need to work on now? What would be goals for me now in, say, the first 6 months or the first year?
Right. So, you know, it's interesting because I feel like these methods work really, and we'll talk about kind of, you know, breaking down the articulating your goals with the SMART method in a second, because I think that's really a valuable part of that. But I feel like on the one hand, these are not quite easy, but these are very reasonable methods when everybody's kind of has more or less the same status in a hierarchy. So if you're all on a team at work, or this is a Facebook community of people with common interests, you know, and you talk about using social media to kind of ask for help, which I think is a great method as well. And I've used that technique as well. How does it fit in if you're kind of asking up or asking down? So asking up is the harder one. Like let's just take a simple example. You're asking your boss for a raise and you decide to use the quick start method. Like you might say, you're number five here. You know, my biggest hope is to really accomplish big things for you over the next year. Like I'm really, really excited about the work we're doing, but I need $2,000 more per year because I just had a kid and it has costs and I don't want to have to go for another job and blah, blah, blah. That's scary asking upwards for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think it depends. There's two parts there. One is that there seemed to be a request related to the work that they were doing for the, you know, for the boss and for the company. The other was this other side, I want to get a raise. I don't think I would ever connect those two in the same session, in the same request, because then it really sounds like, if you do this for me, then I'll do that for you. I would always begin with what is the, you know, what's the higher purpose here? What is the, you know, what is the superordinate goal of the organization? What is my boss trying to accomplish? What am I trying to accomplish? And how can that be connected to what's important to my boss and what's important to the organization? That's part of the meaningful part of a request, that you should explain why it's meaningful. And in a company or an organizational context, it's meaningful for you, but it's also meaningful for the people you're working with, such as your boss, who has objectives, who has goals, and meaningful for the organization as well. And if you could say how you're serving all three of those, then it becomes almost impossible. There might be some constraints, but almost impossible for your boss to supply the resources that you need. You know, the boss is dependent on you as well to do your job. And the better you do your job, the better your boss is going to look and be able to meet his or her objectives.
So if you were using something similar to the quick start method, and then we can also get to the articulating your goals method, and then the vision method, how would you ask? And this is obviously like a basic one, but how would you ask for a raise? Everyone has a different idea of what it means to optimize your health. So I go with my experience. The truth is, there's no such thing as the perfect diet. I have learned that across 500 podcasts with peak performers. Everyone's got a different diet, but they all eat healthy. What's good for me is Athletic Greens. Trust me. I've interviewed, I don't know, everybody from Rich Roll, Dr. Oz, Sanjeev Chopra, Jocko Willink, Jesse Itzler, Tim Ferriss, so many health experts. So you have to find what's good for you. And here's what I really like about Athletic Greens. I feel like I'm outsourcing my health to them. And I am a big believer in outsourcing everything in my life to as many people and institutions as possible. The people of Athletic Greens have spent 10 years working with doctors, nutritionists, and naturopaths, and they continue to optimize their formula based on new science and discoveries. I've got 75 whole food sourced ingredients in my body once I have a single glass of Athletic Greens. I feel good, I'm energized, and I can go on to my idea list for the day, or a podcast, or writing, or whatever else I'm doing. So here's what I did. I set up a deal for the listeners of this podcast because I'm really into this. Go to athleticgreens.com/James and you can get 20 free travel packs, which is a $79 value, with your first purchase. Just go to athleticgreens.com/James and claim your special offer today. Available in the US, Canada, UK, and EU. That's athleticgreens.com/James. Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast, and the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
How would I ask for a raise? You know, so this is so context specific.
Yeah, just make up a context.
Yeah. All right. So when was the last time that I asked for a raise? You know, Adam, in our world, that's kind of an odd thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like you're asking for somebody to give you a whole bunch of extra committees to join along the way.
That's right. That's right. Or other classes to teach. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but let's just say like it's in some corporate hierarchy. There's a VP of marketing who works for a senior VP of marketing, and you know, sales are up and business is, you know, going along, and now the VP wants to make some more money.
Yeah. Again, it is so context specific, but I guess I guess it just seems so naked and blatant to say that, okay, I need to make more money, right? I need to be paid more. I would really focus on the value that's being created by what you do and the worth of that, if there's a justification for a raise. I guess another consideration would be comparisons to what other people are making, a sense of fairness and equity in the pay that you have, or maybe even appeal to what the going rate is in the market. You know, I know in our world, in our academic world, that we're always marking to market, it's called, which is, you know, they figure out, what's a going rate for professors of certain, you know, years of service and productivity and so forth, and then kind of, you know, then how do you adjust salaries accordingly? So that's a formula that is used in the system itself. Adam, what, do you have any ideas here about what's the best way? We ought to refer to our negotiation colleagues here, I think.
Yeah, from teaching negotiations a few times, I think the biggest thing that I learned was that it's often easier to ask for advice than help.
Yes, I actually, as a negotiator, I always start off a negotiation asking for advice. And that, by the way, is in your quick start method. That's one of the ideas in your quick start method.
Right, that's right.
That we're coming full circle. So, yeah, I mean, it's not that difficult to, you know, to go to a senior person who might be a mentor or a sponsor of yours and say, look, here's my goal. Here's why I think my work is worth this based on what Wayne was describing. And, you know, I value your expertise and your experience on how to get things done in this organization. How would you go about approaching this if you were in my shoes? And, you know, best case scenario, that person steps up and becomes your advocate, which some of the research suggests is a common response. Worst case scenario, you get some good suggestions and maybe some additional people to talk to, and you're able to approach the ask with a little bit more clarity and thought than you did before.
Yeah, and I guess when you're asking for advice, you're giving some status to them as well. So they don't want to lose status with you. So they want to give you good advice, which might imply giving you a raise if they're actually your direct boss.
Not only that, there's also some evidence that it actually makes you look smart because, you know, look, you had the wisdom to come to me. You're a genius. Right? Yeah. So I think, you know, it's a little bit different when it's a request for help than you are in some ways putting yourself in a more subordinate position. But I have to tell you, James, that I think that some of these skills are very squarely in the knowing doing gap realm. Where, you know, if you sat down and asked people, okay, what do you need to be able to do to ask effectively? A lot of people would come up with some of these answers if they had enough time to think. But the problem is when we're actually in the situation, we forget to apply them. And that's been, for me, one of the biggest takeaways about learning from Wayne over the past decade and a half is, you know, there's a line that was going around when I first started grad school at Michigan, which was that, you know, we would all be more successful if only we could think as clearly for a day as Wayne does every day. And I think he has this this wonderful gift for, you know, for taking ideas that maybe you've already put into action yourself, but not really articulated and not put into a framework, and organizing them for you so you can actually use them thoughtfully and consistently. And I think that's part of the value of a book like this, is to maybe take what people might do on their best day or in their most reflective moments and make that common practice.
You know, it's so interesting you say that, because I find with a lot of, not a lot of books, but with books like this, that part of the benefit is you might read some of these techniques and say, oh yeah, I kind of do that. Or I remember a situation where I intuitively do that, but kind of formalizing it and putting words to it and putting structure to it, making it an actual tool in a toolbox, becomes incredibly useful, because it allows you to say, okay, now I'm going to use this tool from the toolbox instead of just winging it instinctively, where you might either succeed or fail or whatever. I think that's the benefit of a book like this, where you're giving such accurate and you know, worthwhile tools for how to ask.
I think it's also helpful when you know that there are tools that work, and you know they work because other places, other people have used them. We have a colleague, Bob Quinn, who says if it's real, it's possible, which means that if it works someplace, then it's real. you might have to adapt it to make it work for you, but to know that there's a tool or a practice that is effective in the workplace or in one's life, I mean, that's helpful to know that it can work, and it can work for you too.
So let's look at articulating your goals, because that's where your SMART process comes in as well. I think that's really good as well. I think a lot of times people they just ask for something, but they don't quite define the parameters of what they're asking, like the timeline for it, the metric for success, if the ask was met, and so on. Maybe describe this a little more. I don't know if you have a specific example, or I mean, you have an example in the book, or you have a couple examples, but maybe describe articulating your goals a little more, because I think this is the meat of a lot of these chapters.
Yeah, we developed the SMART criteria because we found that people needed a little help with making an effective request. And so if you think about the SMART criteria in advance, you have to be intentional and have to really think through what you're asking for and why. So we can quickly go through each of those. Now, SMART has a traditional definition, and a couple of those letters I define differently. But the S is for specific. And we found over time, using some of the tools like the reciprocity ring in the book, is that a specific request triggers people's memories of what they know and who they know. Oftentimes people think, well, I'll make a general request because I'll be casting a wide net. But we have found that general requests don't get much help. It's the very specific ones that do. The M, and this differs from the traditional definition of M.
Wayne, can I ask you, can you describe what's an example specific request versus a too general request?
I can give you the most general request I ever heard was from an executive from the Netherlands who was participating in one of our executive education programs, and I was using some of the tools from the book. And he said, and I went through the criteria and everything, but he said, my request is for information. And so I kind of looked at him and I blinked and I said, could you elaborate? And he says, no, it's confidential.
So I see.
And so it was like, so that's the most general request I ever heard. Of course, he got absolutely no help because people didn't know how to. He actually was very generous. He helped a lot of people. But you know, that's the most general I ever heard. And the most specific, I've heard many, many specific ones. But one for me is that, so my wife, Cheryl, and I this year is our 30th year of marriage.
Congratulations.
So this goes back 20 years when we had just created the reciprocity ring. And I had made a near fatal mistake coming up on our 10th wedding anniversary when I asked Cheryl what she wanted to do to celebrate, because number 10 was a big milestone. And without a moment's hesitation, she said, I want us to be on Emerald Live in New York City to celebrate our 10th wedding anniversary. And so, you know, Emeril Lagasse, the BAM chef, right? You know, very popular for many, many years. And we're real fans. We used to watch the show. And we'd try to get tickets. It was like impossible. But an opportunity to make that a very specific request, which is that, look, here's the date of my 10th wedding anniversary. I don't plan on having two 10th wedding anniversaries, so this is the only one. And, you know, I made that request to a group of students and explained why it was important and so forth. And one thing led to another where we got an introduction to a producer in New York, and I could go into all the details, but one thing led to another. We were Emeril's guest on Good Morning. We met him on Good Morning America. That was the producer. He gave us two tickets to go across town for a filming of the Food Network show of the one that he was really famous for, Emeril Live. And to make it even better, it was the week of our anniversary, and they were filming Valentine's Day, which I didn't know in advance. And to make it, I could even go one step further, which I had, we didn't have much money when we got married, and my wife never got a wedding ring, so I had a secret one in my pocket, and they permitted me to give her the ring on air. And it was this totally magical experience. And I remember the whole place erupted in applause, and we kind of spilled out into an alleyway in New York, and people came up and they said, how did they find you? And I said, we found them. And then they really looked at it, didn't know what we were talking about, but it was through making a request, saying why it was important, super specific. And then the generosity of our students made it happen.
And also now, meaningful. It's the 10th year anniversary, you know, with your wife. So,
yeah. Yeah, and that, you know, this one student, they were married, the one that made the connection. But, you know, students were married. They knew about anniversaries. They remembered their parents' significant anniversaries. So it was very meaningful and certainly action-oriented.
I have to jump in on this because I remember seeing the video when I was first introduced to the reciprocity ring. And I remember hearing, Wayne, you can tell me if this is true or not, that when you would run these exercises where all your students would make requests and try to help one another, that sometimes they would ask you to make a request and you always refused.
I did. You know, I'd refuse. And to be totally honest, now looking back, it was because it was hard for me to make a request. You know, I wanted to stay in the powerful position, right? Not really revealing what I might need. I have since overcome that many, many years ago. And so that was a breakthrough for me too, because it was actually my wife's assistant, who was one of our MBA graduates, had suggested to me. She said, you know, you're going to run this program for the students. Why don't you make a request? And I said, no, I can't. I'm the instructor. And she said, no, make a request. You know what Cheryl really wants. And so with that, it was that kind of gave me the courage to actually make that request. And it was very early on in the reciprocity ring, so I didn't yet have the experience that miracles happen when people ask. Like six people came forward. And a funny one was that somebody knew somebody who was dating Emerald's daughter, which was true, but it was also true that they broke up. But there was one connection that
because,
worked
because,
out.
Because he made that ask to Emerald's daughter, he said, I got this professor who wants to go to Emerald Live. And the daughter just like, how could you take advantage of me like that? We're breaking up. So you saved your own relationship at the cost of that poor soul who you asked.
You know, I feel bad. I didn't realize that until now.
You know, but what's interesting though too is, let's look at your SMART criteria. So it was specific. It was meaningful because, not necessarily because you were married, but because you were going to get your divorce if you didn't satisfy your wife's need here. It was action oriented. You needed tickets. It was realistic because it's not like you were asking for a trip to Mars. You were asking to go to a TV show, and it was time bound. There was a specific date that was and that's your SMART. It's your SMART. And I think then it's people can wrap their heads around it and figure out if in their network or in their toolkit of things they can provide, it's very specific. It's all these things. So they know yes or no right away, whether they can do it and how easy it is to either help or not help.
Absolutely. And, you know, of those five criteria, there's two that are often neglected. It's the M and the T, the meaningful part and the time-bound part. So part of what, when we use some of these tools, and even though I'll go through all of this and I'll give examples, when people are actually making requests, they'll often not say why it's important, why it's meaningful, or give a deadline or an extremely vague or general deadline. But, you know, with a little bit of coaching, then people kind of get into the swing of it and realize that they need to do that. And, you know, it's the meaningful part that really motivates people, I think, to respond. It's an emotional connection. And time is also a motivator. If you say, I need something, sometime in 2020, that's not as motivating as saying, look, I really need it next week, and here's why I need it next week. That urgency will motivate people to respond.
And, you know, there's another thing there, too, which is you asked your network, your collective, this collective body of people who were willing to, you knew were going to be willing to respond to you. So I think the network effect there is very important.
Absolutely. And sometimes we limit ourselves to our immediate circle, maybe our inner circle, and we figure we need to know who has the answer, who has the resource. And that can be effective, but it's also very limiting. So oftentimes it's out there and somebody doesn't know where it is. You don't know where it is, but you know who to ask who might know. I call it the two-degree or the two-step method. So I have a colleague of mine, Adams as well, Jeff DeGraff, who uses this all the time, where he'll say, you know, we're trying to help some innovator get some resources, and I don't know who has those resources, but I know who to ask who knows who has those resources. So it's 2 degrees of separation. He told me he actually used that 180 times in 1 year with incredible effectiveness. Another is that you can broadcast a request to a group. You could do that through, say, LinkedIn, or maybe there's a company intranet, or it's Slack or Yammer or something else. Could be the Givitas technology that Adam and I have had a hand in developing. But oftentimes asking a group can be really effective. Because what so let's say another way I can illustrate the network effect is, you know, James, if you ask me an accounting question, you might think, you know, does Wayne know anything about accounting? And the answer is not very much. So you wouldn't normally ask me, but I know lots of world-class accountants, and Adam knows lots of world-class accountants.
I'm sure your parties are really fun.
Yeah, they're really fun. That's right. Oh, I'm not sure we invite them to our parties, but we know them.
You know, we don't seem to get invited to theirs either. Maybe they don't throw parties. I don't know.
There's some reciprocity going on there, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the thing is that, you know, if I'm trying to figure out, in fact, you know, a boss often makes this mistake when they hire someone. They'll say, after the hire said, well, you know, how can I help you? And that puts a huge burden on the other person because they have to figure out, okay, what do I need? What are my goals? What would I ask for? What does this person know? Who do they know? It's impossible to figure all that out. So a much more effective question that a boss or a leader can ask is, what do you need? Right? Because like I say, and when they learn, say, well, maybe I can't help you, but I have a big network and I know someone who can. I've even advised some people to say with a new hire, say, well, what do you need? And the answer might be in the beginning, I'm not sure, or I don't know right now. They say, okay, well, think about it. I'll circle back in 2 weeks and ask you again. Well, that puts the new hire on notice that they've really got to be thinking about their job, what they're trying to accomplish, think about the goals are, what they might need. And within 2 weeks, I can guarantee you they're going to have a really good request that they can pose to their boss.
You know, there's so many interesting things to unpack with what you just said. But also I want to address what Adam said about you, which is that, and you acknowledged, which is that initially you were afraid to ask your group. And again, it's ask is so much related to kind of your status within a group, or at least superficially it seems that way. And I think, you know, part of the reasons you wanted to write a book about ask is because perhaps it was difficult in some ways for you and you had to kind of learn how to overcome that, and learning created, gave you the knowledge of how to formalize this and study it and write a book on it. But, you know, there is something to be said about people want to help you. And sometimes you're doing them a favor when you ask, and it looked in this situation with your wife, they were happy to help you and create this story for you.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that people, I think there's two kinds of positive emotions involved in giving and getting help. One, of course, is the what economists call the warm glow of giving, that it feels good to give to someone, to help someone else. But there's also gratitude for help received. That's the other emotion that people have, the other positive emotion. And there's some research that I've done with Nat Buckley where we found that gratitude for help received is one of the big motivators for paying it forward and helping somebody else. Yeah, so that in that there's always two parties to every exchange or every request, and in this case there's two positive emotions. There's the warm glow of giving and gratitude for help received.
You know, and the other thing I was just thinking about what you said is that there's a strong link between asking and honesty, or lying, depending on how you look at it. So you ask in the situation where the boss asks the employee, what do you need? And the employee says, I'm not sure. Or the employee might say nothing. And then the boss says, well, I'm going to check back with you in 2 weeks. If you think about it, almost every lie probably is coupled with an ask. Like if you say, hey, where were you last night? Nowhere. They would not have lied if you hadn't asked. You know, as part of what you said, well, I'm going to check back with you in 2 weeks, you know, and in this case, the boss has status, so the employee has to come up with something. It's kind of a way of getting over, you know, a lot of lying has to do not just with like being some sort of pathological liar, but maybe a fear. Oh, if the employee might think, if I admit I need something, maybe I'm not good enough to be an employee here. So a lot of lying comes from fear, and the boss is sort of not only putting on notice that I'm going to ask this again, but hey, that it's okay to answer this in an honest way.
That's right. And the boss is also starting to establish the norm of asking. Hmm. In fact, you know, I would say that, you know, the manager, the superior, their boss should be a role model of the behavior that they want, that they need to request, they need to ask. So I'm talking to a group of cardiovascular surgeons, and I was telling them some of the stories, and one of the surgeons came up afterwards and he said, you know, he said, I finally figured out when I was, you know, a new surgeon, very unsure of myself, which didn't sound good for a surgeon to me, but he said, I was very unsure of myself. And he said, there was this much older surgeon that always come up to me and said, I need your help. Can you help me with something? And he would, of course he would help. And what he realized is that the person was training him to ask for help, role modeling that behavior and making a safe environment for people to speak up and to ask for what they needed. And he was really quite a, you know, a role model of that. In fact, I give you another example, which is Dr. Salort Pons, who is the CEO and director of the Detroit Institute of Arts. And he told me that when he became the director, the CEO, that he really startled everyone because he would always make requests. And I think he put it really well. He said, you know, it's a real leadership moment when you make a request of somebody that you work with. You know, it creates a leadership moment for them, and it's an opportunity to co-create a solution. Hmm. And I think that's a real positive act of leadership.
So you guys have taken the next step with this, which is to essentially, what do you call it? You've turned it into an application that you could sell to corporations and to facilitate teams asking each other for help. Because as you've just mentioned, there's so much evidence in both leadership and in effectiveness and in productivity that asking for help has benefits. And often, which is the reason why you wrote this book, often people have a hard time asking or getting out of that shell or feeling comfortable, whether they're leaders or employees. So tell me about Givitas and the reciprocity ring, which is part of it, and what you guys are doing.
Yeah, I'll start, give a little bit of the history of it, and then Adam, if you wouldn't mind, and adding some more as well. So Cheryl Baker and I created the reciprocity ring 20 years ago, almost to the day, and it's a group activity. It's going to sound very simple, but there's a real recipe, so we train people how to use it. But essentially, it's an opportunity for people to make a request for something that they need, and they spend most of their time helping other people meet the request. And it creates what we call generalized reciprocity. So direct reciprocity, James, I help you, you help me, which is great. We'd want that to happen. But generalized is that, you know, Adam helps me, and I feel grateful, and I pay it forward, and I help you. And so we found in the reciprocity ring that 85% of what happens is that indirect form. So the people you help are not the people who helped you. But people have to be in the same place at the same time for this to happen. And over the years, we were always asked, can you digitize this? Can you make a technology where we don't have to be in the same place at the same time and we can have much larger groups?
I don't understand. Why do you have to be in the same place at the same time?
Oh, for the reciprocity ring, it's a group activity, like a team activity.
I see. So everybody knows that you paid it forward.
No. Oh, we haven't gotten to the technology yet.
Okay.
The reciprocity ring happens in real time in small groups who are all gathered together in the same physical space. And so they're like a little group together, usually in groups of 24 that we do it, and people will make a request to the entire group, to the other 23. The other 23 will think about how they can help. They have the answer, or they can tap their external network, and people go around and make the requests that they have. So people are requesting. And later on, when you see who you helped and who helped you, you see it's really often very different people. But again, it's a face-to-face activity. So now take that idea. So it's synchronous. You have to be in the same place at the same time for this to actually work. So the idea with the digital version is that you could take that same idea of the reciprocity ring. You could take those principles and create an application, a platform, or even an app that would enable people to do the same thing. But because you're doing it through your smartphone or your computer, you don't have to be in the same place at the same time. You could be anywhere in the world. So we have groups now that are, you know, of, you know, a couple of thousand people. We have a number of these different communities that that have been established. And it's really quite amazing. And, you know, a lot of these people don't know each other. They may have some affinity. They might be in the group because they're all HR directors or HR managers. But people will make some pretty big requests and amazing how generous people are responding to those requests. So that's, yeah, so the Reciprocity Ring is a face-to-face activity for small groups, and then the Givitas is the digital version for much, much larger groups. Adam, what would you add?
Well, I would say, you know, I first learned about this when I saw Wayne do the Reciprocity Ring live. I think it was 2006. And I was just floored by a few things that I saw happen. The first one was that so many of the people in the room, I think this was a group of executives the first time I saw it, so many of them, when they had to make a request, had not given a moment's thought to what they might want or need. And it was tough for them to even figure out, well, what in the world would I ask for? And that, I thought that was just a powerful thing to watch. And then the next thing that happened was people were able to get help on the most unusual range of requests. You know, Wayne has these great examples like the Bengal Tiger, which I'm a huge fan of, or the PCS alkaloid, which he can go into. But I was just stunned at, you know, you hear these requests and think there's no way anybody in this room could do anything to help them. And the vast majority of the people got multiple offers, you know, from people who thought they could help. And then, you know, there was real follow-up afterward. And so it was almost like watching people, they'd sort of come clean about some of their biggest dreams that they hadn't shared with other people. And then they got support sometimes from friends and colleagues who never even knew what they were after. In other cases, from complete strangers.
So wait,
who were happy to help.
Did someone want like a Bengal tiger as a pet?
Well, I can provide some details on that one. Let me pick up first on a point that Adam made, is that, you know, early on, I used to give what I've come to think of as kind of my Adam speech when I would introduce the Reciprocity Ring, and I would say I'd really emphasize the importance of generosity, of being a selfless giver. And what I found was that, like Adam was saying, is that that was rarely ever the problem. And so over time, I had to switch, and that was really the beginning of the book, is that I had to switch to really emphasize the requesting part. You know, that there's a giving-receiving cycle, but it's requests that really drive the whole process. And so I really had to focus a lot more on getting people to ask, because I knew the generosity would follow, right? Yeah, so the Bengal Tiger, that was one of the early ones. I was running the Reciprocity Ring in executive education in one of our programs here at the Ross School of Business at Michigan. And people, I had enough time, I could run two rounds so people could make two requests. And in the first round, it's something personal related to your family, community, hobby, whatever it might be. And the other one is work-related. That would be the second round. And in the first round, we had a banker from New Delhi, India, who had traveled all the way to come to this program. And he made this impassioned plea. He said that he was a naturalist and he had done all these things. And his bucket list item was to see a Bengal tiger in the wild. And this was early on with the Reciprocity Ring. So I figured this person's getting no help. And I was getting a little anxious about it. And I was totally amazed. I mean, no one lived on a continent that had a Bengal tiger on it that wasn't in captivity. And yet this person got so much help. Somebody knew somebody who led safaris. Somebody knew somebody who owned a game preserve. And I was so curious about this. I stayed in touch with this banker. And because of a connection that had been made in the Reciprocity Ring, in Ann Arbor, he was in the right place at the right time to finally see a Bengal tiger in the wild. And that's when I started to see two things, that it's the request that really drives the whole process, and you never know what people know or who they know until you ask.
You know, that's why there's a lot of evidence that when you are looking for a job, it's not your connection, it's not your first degree connections that find you the job. It's usually your second degree connections that find you the job, meaning the friends of friends, say, who help you find a job, which makes sense because exponentially there's going to be a lot more of those, but also is a little bit counterintuitive because you expect your friends to be the direct. That's the first instinctive response, but it turns out it's the friends of friends.
Right. Well, you should always ask your friends and your colleagues, but if it's a close friend, that means that your networks overlap quite a bit. It's those indirect connections where your networks don't overlap as much. And as the further you go out and say those concentric rings, 2 and 3, 4 degrees of separation, it's different worlds. And what the connections do is they're really a conduit to a different network. And that's where the information is, whether it's a new job or job opportunity, whether it's a resource that you need, whatever it might be, information, knowledge, even advice. So that's why it's important to think in network terms, not just your close circle of friends and colleagues when you make an ask.
So you've launched this. How's it? I meant to ask also, have you used this with like local governments? Because it seems this would be an amazing opportunity for very bureaucratic, often very siloed local governments where the different silos have a hard time communicating. Seems like this would be a very effective application for them to use digitally.
Yes, I think it would be. We haven't done any local governments, but the problem that you described, a siloed organization, that occurs almost anywhere. And the Givitas is a real silo buster. As long as you have people from the different silos that are in the Givitas network or the Givitas community. So it's starting to be used by a lot of different associations. You know, associations have people from all over, different organizations, different companies, different industries sometimes. But they have something in common, like they're all HR directors, or they're all, you know, finance experts, so they're all whatever. And they can give and get a lot of help from one another. You know, for example, is that if you're an HR director in one company and you've run into a problem that is unique to you, it's probably been solved someplace else, right? And by using Givitas and reaching thousands of other HR directors, what we're finding is that, oh yeah, there's three solutions to that problem, a unique problem, a novel problem for you, but other people have already solved it. That's the power of the network. It's the power of the ask when you have that broad and diverse network.
It's interesting because, go ahead, Adam.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, one of the things that Wayne opened my eyes to when I was first watching him do the reciprocity ring that I think has really scaled up in Givitas is, you know, not only are people hesitant to ask, not only do we know that if they overcome that barrier of asking, then the vast majority of moments of help and generosity happen in response to a request, not an offer. But we also know that when people, when they overcome that barrier, when they make the ask, they tend to go to those people that they know well and trust. And that means, you know, they are going to those closest ties with the redundant knowledge like Wayne was talking about. It also means that they tend to seek out the person who's most available or accessible to them, as opposed to the best expert or the most connected colleague that they have. And I think one of the things that's been amazing to see in Givitas is you bring together a group of people who have, you know, maybe some common goals or backgrounds or experiences, but wildly different knowledge and connections. And so it immediately puts you in touch with the person who's best able to answer your question, or who's able to open the door to a different community that you didn't even know existed. And I think the potential there to me is tremendously exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Like this reminded me of the conversation. I had a podcast recently with Eric Adams, who's the Brooklyn Borough president. And he's also the front runner for the next mayor of New York, that election. And you know, Brooklyn, I don't know if you know this, would be if all the boroughs of New York City were cities, Brooklyn would be the third largest city in the United States after LA and Chicago. And he was describing problems that kind of, you know, that he's been solving or problems that he can't solve because they're all throughout New York City that remind me of some of these problems you're encountering that Givitas solves. So it's interesting, you know, translating this into you know, the bureaucracy of government.
Uh-huh. Well, it also makes me think. I've heard from a couple of congressmen that one of the reasons we face such a divide in Washington today is high speed transportation. Hmm. That when it was much more difficult to travel cross country, people would, you know, they'd head over from Washington or California, and they'd basically be stuck there for 4 or 5 days, and so they'd have meals together, they'd get to know each other, they'd bond, and then they'd end up helping each other. And it was a lot easier then to get things done. And now, you know, people fly in, they go to a session, and they fly back, and this doesn't happen. And so I think what we ought to do is we ought to make the House and the Senate go through Givitas and see what happens after they've helped each other.
I'd vote for that. It sounds like a good plan.
That's a wonderful plan. What a great idea. You know, and I would say if we actually ran that experiment, I would put a couple of types of requests off limits. No requests that are political. No requests related to your work. I would have them all focus on personal requests. Requests related to their families, to their hobbies, to if they're involved in a religious or spiritual organization or something like that, but just personal stuff. And I've seen the most acrimonious relationships break down when you get people to really just focus on sharing those things, you know, their dreams, their aspirations, but not about their work, right? Their families, where they grew up, all that stuff. And what people invariably discover is that they have a lot of common and they have this common humanity. And that really, really breaks down the barriers and provide the foundation for then future cooperation.
Well, this reminds me of the, and maybe Adam, you might have mentioned this in Give and Take, I forget, but the Benjamin Franklin technique where he had an enemy in the Pennsylvania, you know, state legislature or the state Senate. And he asked this guy always, you know, would argue with Benjamin Franklin and vote against him and so on. So Benjamin Franklin one time went up to him and said, "Hey, I hear you have a great book collection. Can I borrow XYZ book?" And the guy was surprised a little bit. He said, "Sure, you could take this book." Benjamin Franklin took it. A week later, he gave it back. And forever after, that guy who he had asked for help from, you know, borrowing this book, that guy was his ally rather than his enemy, which is interesting.
Okay, so let's pause on that for a second, because that's a great counterpoint, James, to your earlier concern that sometimes asking hurts. In this case, it helped. Wayne, I'm curious, since you've studied this pretty extensively, what's your sense of why that worked? Was it the pride that the adversary felt in owning the rare book? Was it Benjamin Franklin, you know, sort of admitting that, you know, that he wasn't better than him? How would you analyze that?
You know, I read an account by a psychologist who said that it was what Franklin was doing was demonstrating an affiliative motive, the desire for a more positive connection in the ask. And that was the reason why it was received and helped to transform their relationship. And I think that makes sense, you know, is that, you know, oftentimes, you know, if you don't think about a transaction, you think about when you're asking someone, it's part of a relationship. And when you go to that person, you're saying that you, Adam, you talked before about if you go to someone, ask them for advice, and it raises their perceptions of your competence because they say, because you're smart enough to come to me for advice. I think the same sort of thing here, you know, is that this person has something that Franklin valued. He was able to help out and, you know, inferred that Franklin wanted a more positive connection with him. And maybe because Franklin also demonstrated a little vulnerability by putting himself out there, making this request. In fact, I remember a student here at Michigan who was in student government and an undergraduate, a senior, and he was explaining to me about this huge conflict that he was having with someone else in student government. And I said, why don't you think about something that you could share with that person that might be helpful, something that you could just offer that person, like, and I said, maybe read something that, you know, what this person's interests are, you could share it with that person. And he tried it out and he came back in amazement. And he said, you know, when I did that, it's like the animosity kind of melted away. And it was like, I guess she figured that I was thinking about her and I did something positive for her that maybe I have that affiliative motive. So a little bit different than the Franklin effect, but I think it's that same thing.
So this does bring me back to my personal fears of asking. Like, let's say, you know, I'm writing a book and I want someone I vaguely know or as a connection of a connection to who's let's say super famous to write the foreword, and you know, I can use the smart tools, you know, be specific, meaningful, and so on. But I feel like there's an extra something I need to do. Like I have to make sure it corresponds to their agenda somehow, so that, or their vision of the world, so that and show that it corresponds with mine in a way that's going to move us both forward if they write the foreword of my book. You know, I'm not thinking of a specific example. That's like a made up example, but that type of ask where it's going to require time and thought from them. And I really have to be persuasive in my ask. And by the way, asking stuff like that scares the hell out of me. Like I hate it. I'm so afraid of it.
Well, so James, I think we have an experiment. You need to run then.
Yeah. Well, how can I
experiment?
How can I experiment in safe ways?
Well, I would use the SMART criteria and to really, you know, take some time to answer every one of those items. You know, what is it specifically I need? Why is this meaningful, not only to me, but to the other person, and so forth. And I think that will take you far down the road in figuring out how to make an effective request, but also being sensitive to the other person in terms of their time and their commitments. When's a good time to ask? When's not a good time to ask? Some people like to be asked in an email. Some prefer face-to-face. You know, to be sensitive to all that is also showing respect for the person. And then again, that it's a request is simply a request. It's not a demand. And then remind yourself. Yes, go ahead.
Well, how do you determine, you know, what's the right sensitivity? So, you know, when do they like to be asked? And you know, these other things. Like, and again, I feel like I and maybe I'm mistaken, but I feel like I have to be overboard on how this helps their own agenda, so it doesn't even feel as much like an ask.
Yeah, I don't think you have to be overboard. I think you have to be genuine and authentic. You know, well, you want to be intentional about it, but you also want to do it in the positive spirit. You know, that this is part of, I don't know, I think about part of it is it's participating in life, right? Giving and getting help. And that making your request is maybe giving this person a chance to, you know, to do something that's meaningful to them as well. And then if you do get turned down, to just take it for that. It's just, you know, it's just that. It doesn't mean anything beyond that, that you got turned down.
Yeah, I think that's it too. I think being able to handle rejection is part of it as well. Well, you know, you guys, this book has been so, asking in general is so hard for me. Like you had an example earlier where, you know, sometimes you don't even like you don't even know what, if someone asks you, what do you need? You've never asked for anything. You don't even know what you need. You've blanked it out so much because you're so either afraid of asking or you never ask or you feel it's inappropriate to ask. I think I fall a little bit into that category, and this book's incredibly useful in terms of developing the tools for something that's so difficult. Like asking is sort of up there with public speaking in terms of the fears people have in life. Like, you know, and again, the basic example is asking for a promotion or, you know, something like that, or a raise. It's just so difficult for people. They have to like spend months getting the courage up. And I think this provides really an outline of the tools where if you just think in these tools and really, like you say, thoughtfully go over all the criteria and even write it down and practice it. This is going to be so useful, I know, for my life. And you also have this a section later on, which I encourage people to read also about what you do in the times you make mistakes and how you deal with those. I really appreciated that section, and it reminded me of the book Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink. But anyway, I highly recommend All You Have to Do is Ask, and the subtitle is How to Master the Most Important Skill for Success by Wayne Baker. And Adam Grant, also, thank you for being on this podcast, author of Give and Take and Originals and Option B, such great and game-changing books. And both of you, good luck on Givitas and the Reciprocity Ring. And Adam, I'm glad to see you being involved in entrepreneurship. Your whole story and Originals about how you didn't get involved in Warby Parker kind of showed you had this desire to get out there and sell something.
Thanks for the reminder. No, I'm grateful to be involved in Givitas. I think the work that Wayne has done is brilliant. And the idea that if we could connect more people who need help with, you know, with colleagues and, you know, acquaintances and even strangers who are happy to give it, that seems like a great way to make both asking and receiving easier.
Yeah, this is so interesting, and it's a good compliment, I think, to give and take, which is why, Wayne, probably you referred to Adam and give and take quite a bit in the book. And Wayne, also, you know, just putting the math together in your stories, sounds like in the next few weeks is your 30th anniversary with Cheryl. So congratulations on that. What are you going to do for the 30th anniversary to top Emeril?
Well, that's a good question. It's a couple months from now, so have some time to think about it. But this is a good reminder that I got to start thinking about that.
Yeah, well, don't forget to ask.
That's right. And ask in advance, right?
Yeah.
Give myself enough time. So, well, this has been wonderful. I've really appreciated this opportunity. I've enjoyed the conversation. Adam, so great to be on with you and to be working with you on Givitas and Give and Take. And James, thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, you guys. And hopefully we'll all talk soon.
Thank you. To be continued.
Thanks. Bye.